Mornings for the Master here on the Gospel Radio Network. Your host this morning, Ryan Smithy, joined with Chip Horton.
Hey, y'all!
And certainly thankful that you've joined us. Chip tells me we've already got a few in the chat room this morning.
Sure do.
Certainly send out a greeting to help me again, though.
We got Miss Ann and got my bride in there.
All right. And so we're thankful for them joining in with us, also others. And encourage you, if you have opportunity, sit down at your computer, log into the website, and log in there. Just once you click that big Listen Live button, scroll on down, just type in a name and click Enter, and you can join in that chat window. Maybe you have a comment, a question, something else that you would like to add, or just see sometimes the discussion that goes on there that we don't even get to on air. Mm-hmm. And certainly encourage you to participate in that. Well, we are continuing to have a great week. I'm going to call it Gospel Meeting Week 2017, with the numerous gospel meetings that are going on this week. I want to continue reminding you of opportunities that you have to get out to the Bangs Church of Christ that is having Ronnie Hayes out this week. Their gospel meeting continues. Also, Hamilton. In Central Texas, that is having Denny Wilson out this week for a gospel meeting. Back up here in this Northeast Texas area, we know of Fruitvale that has Mike Bonner in. Also, Jim Laws is hosting a gospel meeting there at the Broadway Church of Christ in Tyler. And right here at Mount Vernon, we have Kerry Clark in. And continuing to do a great job there.
That's right.
Invite you out tonight, Matthew chapter 24, he'll be looking at, and then also conclude tomorrow with the Devil's Trot Line. And so been some great and practical lessons, and I hope that you can be with us. If you can't be out, do want to remind you that we're able to stream both the meeting here at Mount Vernon and also from Tyler. And so you have multiple listening opportunities. If you will log into the webpage, you can catch those at the special broadcast links at the bottom of the page. And so certainly thankful for the good efforts that are being put forth. Encourage you to keep these congregations in your prayers and come out and support them if you can. Well, we'll move along. We'll continue talking about David and his great flight from Saul this morning, and I want to start in kind of maybe a different place. I want to go to the New Testament, if you can join us there this morning. Let's go over to Philippians chapter 4, and Paul comes to mind because yesterday we got to look with Richard and Carrie, and we were looking at David as this conflict intensifies. Saul is becoming, in many ways, we almost look at Saul and it's as if he's becoming unhinged in his life. He's unstable. And he begins to have a great rage, a great jealousy towards David, even to the point that he's made attempts on David's life already. And but during that time, one of the things we noted yesterday is note how many times the Bible says, but David acted wisely. He went forth and was faithful. Here's Saul, he's got his problems. David's going about being a faithful servant, first and foremost to God, but even unto Saul. And so his popularity is growing because he's before the people. He's going out with the military. He's being successful. Even though tensions are rising, in many ways, I look at David's life at that point in time, and I said, things are going pretty well for him. I mean, his popularity is building up. You have the songs that are sung. Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. And so his popularity is there. He's become son-in-law to the king. You know, in many ways, you think everything's going fairly well for David. But now the question is going to become, what happens when that is taken away? What happens when David flees for his life? What happens when he's running in fear? What happens when he's having to hide out even among his enemies? Is he able to continue faithfully? And that's going to be the great charge of his life. And that's what reminded me of a statement of Paul there in Philippians chapter 4, as he speaks about a lot of things, but my attention is drawn to verse 12, Philippians 4 and verse 12, when he said, I know both how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me. And, of course, that even backs up into verse 11. I've learned whatsoever state I am in, therewith to be content. And I somewhat see that, I think, in David's life here, because a man ultimately that's described as a man after God's own heart, and we may notice some character flaws maybe in his life today, and certainly we know of later sin in his life, but overall this was a man that whatever was happening was striving to be faithful unto God. If things were going great for him, he wanted to be faithful. If things turned and they were no longer going his way, he wanted to be faithful. And I see that same thing in Paul's life. When things are going great and people want to listen to the gospel, that's great, and I'm ready to go forth and I'm preaching it. And guess what? When things aren't going so well and I'm put into prison and I'm locked up, I'm still trying to be faithful and preaching the gospel. Whatever happens, I know that God is with me. And that can be a great challenge for us, I think, as we look at our own lives. Sometimes I've looked at that and I'm reminded we've got to learn to be content. We've got to learn to be faithful in all things. Sometimes it's just as hard to be content and faithful in the times of prosperity of our lives as it is to be content and faithful in the times of want in our lives. When we think everything's going our way and we think we have it made, we might very well lose focus on what's really important. Yeah. And so I just thought that may be a fitting transition there as things rapidly change in David's life. Anything before we get started there, Chip?
Just looking at the original language there in that verse that you brought to us in Philippians, that idea of being abased even carries with it in the language the idea of humiliated.
Mm-hmm.
And then to abound also carries with it the idea of superabounding or exceed or be the better enough in despair. And certainly he's got both ends of that. You know, in our text today, you know, you think about he's being chased around as an innocent man. Mm-hmm. And then the way that you see him with Nabal, I mean, he's at both ends of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. You know, and
certainly.
So certainly that was a good text to reference. That really made me think in a new direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back. We're going to back up a little from our schedule because we didn't get to some of these things. And we're really going to look at a lot of the events today as kind of the historical account. I think there's some good lessons for us to learn through them. But just to skim through some of these things, in 1 Samuel chapter 20, we can read through this chapter. Saul's wrath will continue against David. He will speak with Jonathan, and Jonathan again shows his true friendship. Mm-hmm. And here was a friendship that he stuck closer to David than even really to his own father. And he saw the faults of his father. He saw the wrong of his father in pursuing after David, and ultimately became an even greater friend to David for warning him. And in chapter 20, we almost see this incredulousness, if I'm probably making up a word there, of Jonathan, that no, you've got it wrong. My father doesn't want to kill you. He's not trying to bring these things upon you. But indeed, as he investigates, he finds, yes, David, you are at risk. And so Saul's wrath is continuing. And I want to jump down there in verse 20. And Chip, if you've got that for us, let's read verse 13 through 15 and see again, I think, almost a prophetic statement that Jonathan's going to make concerning David here.
The Lord do so and much more to Jonathan. But if it please my father to do thee evil, then I will show it thee and send thee away, that thou mayest go in peace, and the Lord be with thee, as he has been with my father. And thou shalt not only, while yet I live, show me the kindness of the Lord, that I die not, but also thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord hath cut off the enemies of David, every one from the face of the earth.
So even Jonathan is seemingly recognizing here, as they're talking about these things, he said, I'll let you know what my father's thinking. But what he's ultimately asking as well is favor. David, I will show you kindness, and if my father, my own father, is plotting against you, I will let you know that you may be able to flee. And yet what I'm asking of you is show me the kindness of the Lord, and not just to me, but even unto my descendants. And we're going to see that as David becomes king. He's going to search out, is there any of the household that I can yet find, and of course will show great kindness to Mephibosheth there in order to show kindness to the house of Saul. Again, going back to these promises he's made unto Jonathan. But then Jonathan is even looking forward, and he begins recognizing the Lord is going to bless you. The Lord is going to be with you. And so he's going to cut off the enemies of David from off the face of the earth, and yet I ask that you remember us. And so to me, Jonathan is looking forward there and begins to recognize these changing times. And then also one thing I wanted to notice there is verse 30 through 33 in that chapter to show the greatness of Saul's anger is even going to begin steering towards his son because of the jealousy and the wrath that he has towards David. And so verse 30 through 33.
Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said unto him, Thou son of the perverse, rebellious woman, do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion and unto the confusion of thy mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom. Wherefore now send and fetch him unto me, for he shall surely die. And Jonathan answered Saul his father, and said unto him, Wherefore shall he be slain? What hath he done? And Saul cast a javelin at him to smite him, whereby Jonathan knew that it was determined of his father to slay David.
Okay, and so Jonathan, there's really no doubt left in his mind what his father thinks about David. I mean, don't even talk to me of the man. You're trying to, you know, Jonathan's trying to reason with him here. What has he really done? And it is going to lash out now, not just at David, but how dare even you? You're my son, and yet you've sided with him. And so we see that anger. We see that even he would lash out at his own son because of the wrath that he has toward David, and recognize now again, even Saul is recognizing, Jonathan, don't you know, this throne will never be yours as long as David's alive. Saul, in the hardness of his heart, still hasn't accepted the will of God. He's already told him, Saul, you're going to be removed, and your family will not continue in this lineage. He doesn't want to accept that, and I think even Saul is beginning to recognize David is well-favored of the Lord. David is being blessed by the Lord. Surely David is being set up as that next king, and that just seems to fuel this wrath. And so even to the point that he would lash out at his son, those are some things that struck me there, that continued wrath building in chapter 20.
Anger's a bad thing, and anger will tear you up from the inside out. And certainly as we go into our text from today, you know, Saul has that moment when he realizes, yep, sure enough, it's David.
and you talk about that anger. I look at Saul a lot, and it's just a sad commentary of what could have been. When you look at his life and you say, here was a man that could have had it all, but ultimately pride was his great downfall. Pride before God, and now pride because he's chasing after David. He doesn't want to let go of what he thinks is his. And like you said, we see it destroying his life, and that is allowed to continue.
But we're just human, you know. I mean, even David, as you get toward it, you know, he's going to he's going to have to be talked down off of a sinful plateau by a young lady. You know, he was at that point too, and certainly, you know, David is human like the rest of us.
Right. And And I personally, there may be some room for disagreement here. I think we see that in chapter 21, some of David's faults. Now David is going to flee. He flees to Nob. There he is going to find the priest Ahimelech, and he's going to go into him and ask him for help. Now Ahimelech knows something's off here. David has men with him, but it's not the full entourage, if you will. Where's your armed guard? Where's all the soldiers that you normally travel with? There's some people with him, but it's not what he would have expected. And so he begins asking questions, and I can't help but look here and see deception in David. And, you know, sometimes I think maybe we try to explain these things away when the Bible simply tells us this is what happened, this is what he did. It didn't justify it. It doesn't say it was right. But he's going to tell him, I'm on a secret mission of the king.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to use that deception to get what he needs. At the same time, not only is he lying about why he's there, but he's going to ask, is there anything here to eat?
Mm-hmm.
And the priest is going to say, well, no, there's the showbread that, if you remember, the showbread was replaced weekly. And so it seems in this account, he says, I've just replaced the showbread. But if you'll think back, Leviticus 24 and verse 9, the showbread was to be eaten by the priest. It was reserved for them. That was their instruction. It wasn't for anyone else. David really had no right to that. And yet he is going to be given that showbread. The priest does at least make the request, as long as you and the young men that are with you are clean, in a ceremonial sense, it seems. As long as you are clean, then he allows it. Now, I look at chapter 24, and personally, I believe Daniel's running in fear instead of faith. That it seems to be he's caught up now in this idea. Things had been going well. God has been with me, but now I am fearful for my life. We see that with great men such as Abraham. We saw it when he fled down into Egypt, and he tells his wife, Sarah, just tell him that you're my sister. Well, there's some truth to that, but it wasn't the truth. I think we see it again as we would fast forward, and the example of just left my mind, but others that will use deception in order for their own protection. I think we see that some even here in the life of David. And so I have a hard time justifying that which he has done here, but we can read through, we can see the account. Jesus is going to refer back to this in Matthew chapter 12. And again, some believe that there was a justified excuse here. I personally think Jesus is looking back at this, and he's not justifying the sin of David. He's actually pointing out an inconsistency in the Pharisees, because they have attacked him. There in Matthew chapter 12, it says, at that time, Jesus, verse 1, went on the Sabbath day through the corn, and his disciples were hungered, began to pluck the ears of corn and to eat. When the Pharisees saw it, they said unto him, behold, thy disciples do that which is not lawful to do upon the Sabbath day. And ultimately, there really wasn't anything sinful here. They weren't working. They weren't laboring. They were eating to fulfill just their need as they passed through the field. And so verse 3, Jesus will say, have you not read what David did when he was hungered, and they that were with him? How he entered into the house of God and did eat the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, neither for them which were with him, but only for the priest. Now, again, some are looking at that and saying, well, there was a greater need, a greater cause, and so it was justifiable. I'm not sure Jesus isn't looking at it and saying, you're attacking me and my disciples. We've done nothing unlawful. But here's David that did do that which was unlawful, and yet you justify him. Hmm. You make excuse for him. You've lifted up David. Where have you charged him with wrongdoing? And so, personally, I believe that account's showing that inconsistency. Now, I don't know, Chip, if you have, I know I'm throwing you off guard since we backed up, but if you had any input or thought there.
I think you're right on target with that. I've heard the same discussion. You know, that's the way the Pharisees were. They walked around with their feathers all plumed out like a peacock, and they'd point a finger at anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly an opportunity to dig on the disciples. Right. They jump all over that, right, no matter what the case.
And so, you know, David is a great man. It's certainly one that we need to look to as an example, but I think the biblical text reminds us David was not a perfect man.
Exactly.
And that's going to be important as you look through the Old Testament. There are continual reminders to me, these aren't the men that are the Savior. Moses was a great lawgiver, but Moses isn't the Savior. Mm-hmm. Noah built an ark to the saving of his house, but sin was still a problem in the world. You know, on through the text, David was a great king, but he's not the King of Kings. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have here within chapter 21 his running in fear, and in that time we see some of the weaknesses there. And so here at Nob, he is able to have some temporary rest. He's able to get food. He also is going to be given the sword of Goliath. And some have pointed out perhaps even the giving of that sword is going to remind him of the great victories he had had when God was with him. Mm. But he will flee from there. He will go to Gath. It's an interesting choice, it seems. Okay. His safety is at such risk in Israel, he's going to flee to the Philistines. Remember, Gath is one of the five principal cities of the Philistines. But he will go there and act as a madman in order to kind of disguise himself, to give protection unto himself. And I love the king's response. He basically says, don't I have enough mad people? Why are you bringing me David? Why are you bringing me this man? And he sends him away. And so David is able to even flee from Gath. In 1 Samuel 22, men are beginning to gather unto David. I think there's both good and bad in this. Look at the type of men that are gathering. If you will, Chip, let's look at verse 1 and 2 of 1 Samuel 22.
David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave Adullam. And when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. And everyone that was in distress, and everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented gathered themselves unto him. And he became a captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men.
Okay, and so he is getting quite a following, and this following is increasing. We're not specifically told, but I can only imagine that there is a charge against David's family as well. If you know anything about him, we want to know where he is, or maybe David's even afraid that they will use his family against him. And so even his family has now come unto him for safety. In the following verses, he's going to strive to provide for them. I see the love of a son unto his parents. Notice what he does there in verse 3. He goes unto Moab, and he asks the king of Moab, let my father and mother stay here. Provide for them safety until I know how things are going to go for me. Hmm. Again, my mind slightly shifts to the cross. Jesus is concerned about his mother. He is concerned about her care. And so is going to entrust her unto one that he has confidence in. Mm. David is providing for his family as well in that sense. But it's interesting to me the people that are coming unto him, and there are those who have really a grudge against Saul. They're unsatisfied with the way things are, and so they're looking to David as a king. And so these have gone out unto him. Mm. That same chapter is going to give us the account of a lowlife, if you will, a Doeg, who has seen David at Nob, and he is basically going to report back to Saul. He looks for opportunity. Seemingly, what he's doing is looking opportunity to find favor in Saul's sight. Mm-hmm. So he will tell him about David being at Nob, and he will tell him about Abimelech and how he has provided, or Ahimelech, excuse me, how he has provided for David. And Saul is going to turn around and command the death of Ahimelech. And Ahimelech rightfully says, I didn't know anything. David came. I believed his story. I thought he was a trusted servant of yours. I provided these things, but I didn't know I was harboring a fugitive. And yet Saul is going to give that command. And if you had any question about Doeg, look there in, if you will, let's look at verse 17 through 19.
17 through 19 and
22.
The king said unto the footmen that stood about him, "Turn and slay the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled, and did not show it to me." But the servants of the king would not put forth their hand to fall upon the priests of the Lord. And the king said to Doeg, "Turn thou and fall upon these priests." And Doeg the Edomite turned, and he fell upon the priests and slew on that day 85 persons that did wear a linen ephod. And Nob, the city of the priests, smote he with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and sucklings, and oxen and asses and sheep with the edge of the sword.
We see Saul's depravity. We know it already in his fierce pursuit of David. But now you attack onto that anybody that seems to have given any support, any comfort to David. He's trying to seemingly make an example here of Ahimelech and these priests. And so you go forth and you kill these priests is the command that he gives to his servants that are with him. And I respect their godly fear is all that I can assume there. Those are men of God. Mm. We're not killing them. We're not doing this. And this is their king that they are being disobedient to. That could cost them their life. But they refuse to do this wicked thing. So he turns to Doeg. Doeg, with no scruples, Doeg, with no morality there, it seems, is willing to go and do this. He slays the 85 priests there, but in addition to that, brings this great pestilence upon the city as he kills men and women and children and infants and goes on this war path, if you will.
Yeah.
And all of that goes back to the anger and the jealousy of Saul. A man who had lost favor with God because he wanted to do things his way. Mm. And so certainly a sad commentary on his continued life, his continued existence there. Chapter 23 tells us of David fleeing again or moving on. He's going to be told that the Philistines have come into the land, and they are attacking the city of Keilah. And so, you know, they've just brought in their harvest. They're being attacked by the Philistines, and David is going to go and deliver them. I love David and his approach here in chapter 23. He is now, if there was any question earlier, he's seeking the favor of God. Do we go up? Is this what you want us to do? And so verse 2 says that David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go and I smite these Philistines?" And the Lord said, "Go and smite them and save Keilah." And even David's men are going to say, "We're afraid. We're afraid to go there." And again, he will inquire, verse 4, and the Lord says, "Go, for I will deliver them into your hand." And then they are willing to go with him. And they go and they deliver the city. But instead of being appreciative, David has just helped King Saul and his land, his realm. But instead of being thankful for that, even more, Saul is going to want to kill David. And so David is once again going to flee. He will ask first again of God. Let's look at verse 11 and 12 here.
11 and 12. "Will the men of Keilah deliver me up into his hand? Will Saul come down as thy servant hath heard? O Lord God of Israel, I beseech thee, tell thy servant." And the Lord said, "He will come down." Then said David, "Will the men of Keilah deliver me and my men into the hand of Saul?" And the Lord said, "They will deliver thee up."
Okay, and so again, the wisdom of seeking after God,
right,
seeking his will. There's so many examples through the Old Testament of those that acted out of impulse and just did that which seemed right in their mind. And yet the wisdom of pausing and asking, what is it that we should do?
Mm-hmm.
And so David has asked, is Saul coming here? Yes, he's coming. Will the people of the city deliver me into Saul's hand? Yes, they will. And so David flees. What's interesting to me, I think there is some room for commentary here on the idea of divine foresight, of free will, because David's asking the question, what is Saul going to do? God tells him what Saul's going to do. Well, what's interesting, Saul doesn't do that. Was God wrong? No. The circumstances of life changed. David, if you stay here, Saul will come. The men of the city will deliver you into his hands. But guess what? If David leaves, Saul doesn't go there. Again, those circumstances change. God was not wrong in what he had said. Sometimes we look at our lives and some people think that God has ordered and made choices of everything of their life. If that was true, then there was something God missed here.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm reading a little too much there, but I certainly think we can look there and understand that God can have foreknowledge of things. Yes, if this is the path that you choose, this is what's going to happen. But you have the choices to make. You have to decide what you're going to do in these circumstances, and what you do there can affect the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that here within David's life. His choices affected those outcomes. And so Saul did not come down to the city, as God had said, because David would flee from there. And so even in our lives, sometimes I think if we're not cautious, we can think, well, there is a certain plan. I've got to do this. I've got to do that. And God has laid all of these things out. If we're not careful, we begin to get to a point in which we think that there is no free will, free choice. And what we've got to understand is because of certain things have happened in our lives does not automatically mean that was the will of God.
Mm.
The circumstances of this life led to that. Carrie dealt with that last night in the sermon.
Sure.
A man that had lost his sons, one to suicide, two others would die within the same year, I believe it was, to drunk driving. Well, a father wanted to blame God. But these were the choices and the actions and decisions that those young men had led themselves up to.
Mm.
And so I see some of that even there in these actions of David.
Mm.
Saul will continue to seek David. Notice there in verse 14, even at the near the end of that verse, it says, Saul sought him every day, but God delivered him not into his hand.
Mm.
This wasn't a passing fancy. This was a rampage. This was an anger that was boiling over, that he desired nothing more than to see the death of David, and yet God was going to be with his servant.
Mm.
Look at there at verse 17 as well. Here we have an occasion where David and Jonathan are reunited even just for a moment here. And he said, fear not. The hand of Saul, my father, shall not find thee. Thou shalt be king over Israel, and I will be next unto thee, and that also Saul, my father, knoweth.
Hmm.
And so if there's any question in our mind again, Saul and Jonathan know the intent that God has here. David indeed will be king.
That's right.
And we even see some close calls here. If you will, verse 26, we have this occasion when David has come down to seek after Saul, and we find out just how close they were and how much God was protecting David on these occasions.
And Saul went on this side of the mountain, and David and his men on that side of the mountain. And David made haste to get away for fear of Saul, for Saul and his men compassed David and his men round about to take them.
All right. And so even this separation here, that God is watching over David. David's trying to flee. Saul's trying to find him. And how close had they come? Well, passing just the other side of the mountain. You know, Saul's men likely even didn't know David's men were over there, whether or not David's men knew or not. But they were able to pass as ships in the night. And Saul would go one way and David would go the other way. And there even be able to enjoy that that safety.
Mm-hmm. And notice God's intervention there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the warning that came. You know, hey, the Philistines are, you know, and Harry was right at the right. cusp of taking David. And God's, you know, even providential hand would right. step in and protect David. That's a beautiful thing to observe.
But they're right at the end, verse 27, where that message will come. You know, Saul's so focused on David. He gets this news, you're needed. Our land's being mm-hmm. attacked. And so Saul will be called away. David has a temporary rest. But lest we think it lasts too long, let's go right back, 1 Samuel 24, verse 1 and 2.
And it came to pass, when Saul was returned from following the Philistines, that it was told him, saying, behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi. Then Saul took there 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel and went to seek David and his men upon the rocks of the wild goats.
Okay, so you have a temporary distraction. You know, there were times earlier on where Saul would throw his javelin at David, but then he could be appeased, and everything seemed to be okay again. That those moments are fleeting. I've been called away to war. I had my mind somewhere else, but I got right back on it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeking right after David again. You know, if anything, I think we can certainly look at the life of Saul and learn how jealousy and anger, hatred, all of those characteristics, you could point to any of those and see how they helped bring about the demise of Saul. They destroyed him. There's no joy that I see in the life of Saul. There's no comfort that I see. He might still be king over all of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But he cannot find joy in that because of the hatred that he has toward David.
Mm.
Another individual that comes to mind there in... Yep. Just drew a blank there. Haman.
Yes.
Haman and Mordecai.
Boy.
Because Mordecai was so frustrated... Because, no.
Haman was,
thank you.
There's a Mordecai. Yeah.
Haman was so frustrated. Here's all the people of Shushan that will bow down to him and humble themselves before him. And there's one man, Haman, that refuses, no, Mordecai that refuses to bow before Haman to the point that there's nothing that can make him happy.
No.
Even to the point where Esther will call him and the king, and he goes back to his family and he says, I'm the only one beside the king that Esther called unto this banquet, but I can't be happy. I've got money, I've got fame, I've got fortune, I've got popularity, but I can't be happy because one man refuses to bow unto me.
Mm.
And he makes this plot whereby he doesn't just want to get Mordecai, he wants to destroy all of his people. And that's the same kind of anger that's eating at Saul, even on this occasion.
Yeah, notice that he takes all the governmental resources.
Yes.
You know, he takes these 3,000 men and goes out. You know, that's probably a lot of that going on even in our government mm-hmm. today, using government resources for your own benefit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I'm mad at this guy.
And, you know, that... That personal rage, and it shows once again why he was unfit to be king, because he would, like you said, use those resources that were at his disposal for his petty and personal problems that he had. We're going to have to watch our time here a little in some of this, but I do want to look at verse 3 through 12, and this chapter is really going to give us an insight to the character of both men, I believe.
3 through 12, and he came to the sheepcotes by the way, where was a cave. And Saul went in to cover his feet, and David and his men remained in the sides of the cave. And the men of David said unto him, Behold, the day of which the Lord said unto thee, Behold, I will deliver thine enemy into thine hand, that thou mayest do to him as it shall seem good unto thee. Then David arose and cut off the skirt of Saul's robe privately. And it came to pass afterward that David's heart smote him because he had cut off Saul's skirt. And he said unto his men, The Lord forbid that I should do this thing unto my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch forth mine hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord. So David stayed his servants with these words and suffered them not to rise against Saul. But Saul rose up out of the cave and went on his way. David also afterward and went out of the cave and cried after Saul, saying, My Lord, the king. And when Saul looked behind him, David stooped with his face to the earth and bowed himself. And David said to Saul, Wherefore hearest thou men's words, saying, Behold, David seeketh thy hurt. Behold, this day thine eyes have seen how that the Lord had delivered thee today into mine hand in the cave. And some bade me kill thee. But mine eye spared thee. And I said, I will not put forth my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. Moreover, my father, see the skirt of thy robe in my hand, for in that I cut off the skirt of thy robe and killed thee not. Know thou and see that there is no evil nor transgression in my hand, and I have not sinned against thee, yet thou huntest my soul to take it. The Lord judge between me and thee, and the Lord avenge me of thee, but mine hand shall not be put upon thee.
You know, I look here, and there's a lot maybe that we could certainly discuss, but you know, David and his men are certainly in hiding from Saul. We have this occasion. You almost wonder, how did this even happen? Mm-hmm. Saul's personal guard failed this day. They didn't clear this cave that Saul would go into to lay down. David and his men, if you will, just happen to be in this cave. Again, maybe this was indeed the providence of God to bring this occasion about. But, you know, David and his men are there, but I can picture them pressed up against the sides of this cave in the darkness where Saul can't see, and he goes in and he lays down and he goes to sleep. And notice the men that are with David, verse 4, they're urging him. There's your enemy.
Kill him.
God gave him into your hand. Go and do what you know you need to do. I mean, that's the peer pressure there. Yeah. I can hear them like Chip there. He's whispering in his ear. Go and get him. Remember who it is that has come unto David. Go back to 1 Samuel 22 and look there in verse 2. I mean, it's the discontented. It's those that have a complaint, those that are in distress, those that were in debt. I mean, these are people that aren't friends of Saul either. They're not looking out for what's best for Saul. They're probably not even looking out what they think is best for David. They're looking out for what they think is best for themselves. And David, in that moment, number one, shows his great character. I'm not going to kill him. Now, he does go and he cuts off a piece of his robe, his skirt there, part of his garment. But notice even David, verse 5, this is going to come back, and he's grieved.
Mm-hmm.
I've not done that which is right. I shouldn't have raised my hand against the king. This is God's anointed. He's still king. He's still in that position.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, again, I think we see the great heart of David. You know, he wasn't always a perfect man. He had his difficulties, his complaints, his temptations. But he stayed his hand from, number one, killing him. But number two, he had a remorse here because I need to show honor and respect. God's raised that man up as king.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, he's told me I'm going to be king. I know that day is coming, and I trust in God. But it needs to happen on God's time and not mine.
That's right.
And I think I would relate there even Romans chapter 12. I thought I had that written down. I'm thinking Romans 12, verse 18 or so. Romans 12:19. The idea that vengeance is mine.
Right.
I will repay, saith the Lord. Mm-hmm. And so David recognizes there's coming a day. Saul is going to be cast down. David's going to be lifted up. But it's not going to be on David's time. It's going to be on God's time. Mm-hmm. And that's what I love and respect for David in this chapter. And so he'll take occasion to go back around whether Saul has left the cave and he rises up, or whether they were able to move out the back of the cabin and cave and come around and show himself and say, Saul, look at what I have. Look at the opportunity that I had before me. I could have killed you today. You've got all these people whispering in your ear saying, David is out to get you. He's trying to kill you. And some reason you think that I'm your enemy. Well, I had opportunity to take your life this day, and I didn't take it. And so he's begging Saul, what have I done? What transgression is there? And asks even there, as you read in verse 12, the Lord judge between us. Mm-hmm. Have I done thee any wrong? And so he will plead for them momentarily. Saul is going to have a softening of his heart. And he will see the uprightness of David and his own wickedness, if you will. Verse 17, he would say to David, you are more righteous than I, for thou hast rewarded me for good when I have rewarded thee evil. Mm-hmm. There's at least some recognition there. I've not done that which is right, but even this day you have, and you have dealt righteously with me in refusing to kill me. Great lessons there, I think, not only in the idea of God's anointed and the idea that we could certainly get into the New Testament, and we could talk about the idea of the powers that be, the government that's been established by the hand of God, the respect that we ought to have unto it, mm-hmm. as long as it doesn't contradict God's will. Mm-hmm. We could certainly talk about vengeance. How many people want that idea that it's mine and I'm going to take it, or I've been wronged and I'm going to show them? And here David was willing to have patience. He says, no, this is going to happen in God's time. He will do that which is right. And, you know, even in that first century, we see Christians that were being persecuted for no reason other than that they were faithful unto God. Mm-hmm. And yet their attitude is, how long, O Lord? You're going to take vengeance. You're going to uphold your name. And so rather than they're fighting back themselves, we see them submitting themselves unto God that judges righteously, even as Jesus had done. And so momentarily, Saul would go home, verse 22, and David and his men got up into the hold. Now notice, David doesn't go home with Saul.
No.
We're not that well patched up, and Saul quickly is going to be back on his heels. But at least for a moment, Saul is satisfied and he would go home. Anything that stands out to you there in chapter 24?
The thing that came to my mind as you were talking about this scenario in the cave is the way that we see men grow. Because mm-hmm. here, no matter how you see it visually in your mind's eye, Saul is learning a great lesson. And he is being shown certainly the way of righteousness. And David is being tested. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got these peer pressure, you know, coming up in his ears, as you mentioned. And he, you know, is certainly being pushed to the limit and had the opportunity. But certainly we see one man learning a lesson and another man learning patience, another man learning, you know, great lessons. And that's us every day. You know, whether we're in the grocery store or whether we're behind the wheel going to Dallas, you know, we are learning lessons. We are seeing things that are going on around us, and we're being tested. Mm-hmm. And so we need to remember, you know, even men like Saul and David, who were human just like we are, constantly on a learning, you know, level. Yeah. That's all of us.
That's right. And certainly it was a lifelong thing there for David, and there were great ups as he climbed that mountain, and there were a few valleys that he passed through, some down points as well, certainly in his life. Well, we're charged with going through 1 Samuel 25. Certainly some great lessons there as well. It starts off very simple statement in verse 1. If you'll grab that for us, Chip.
And Samuel died, and all the Israelites were gathered together and lamented him and buried him in his house at Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran.
You know, you think back on the life of Samuel, and here reigns as the last judge. He was a great spiritual leader in Israel. He did that which he could to ward off the events that have come about, even with the appointment of Saul as king. He warned the nation against that. He's striven to help Saul be the man that he could be and the king that he could be, and would ultimately war against him in that way, even to the point where he was the one that would ultimately have to deliver the message, Saul, your kingdom's departed from you. God's going to rend it out of your hand and give it unto another after his own heart. And yet we come to here, and there's no great fanfare. It's, you know, like so many others, Samuel lived, Samuel died. And great men of God are still going to pass from this life. Great men of God, they were remembered by those in that time. They lamented him. They buried him at his house. But the events of this world kept going on. And I was reading one that had written about this chapter, and he said, you know, it's remarkable to me that there's often little fanfare, but if you think about it, what was there to mourn? Samuel faithfully served God in this life. Now Samuel can go on to his reward. And so rather than a great lament there, we see really a very brief statement concerning his passing. And so Samuel, that great prophet, that judge, that one that had helped rule over Israel, has now died. Now, the remainder of this chapter refers to the event that you mentioned even earlier, and that with Nabal and his wife Abigail. And I encourage you to read through the chapter. We're going to maybe just reference more of it for lack of time. There's some history that we're not given. It's referenced to in this chapter. David has been in this area, and he has been providing protection. You see, David's not just hiding out in the hills. He is still fighting. He's still helping those that are around him. He's even been of aid to Nabal, even though Nabal will not recognize it. We've made sure that no harm came to your shepherds as they were in the field. We made sure that armies didn't come against you. We made sure the wild animals didn't harm you there. And yet now when David goes and he asks of Nabal, will you help us? Will you give us provisions? Nabal is going to provide very curtly, almost to the degree of, who's David? Why should I have reverence or respect unto David?
Yeah.
And there's certainly more than that. He is basically lashing out at David. Who's David? Isn't he the one that's run from his master? He's nothing more than a worthless slave, is almost how he refers here to David. Verse 6, we see that when David has sent to Nabal, he's greeted him peaceably. He's wishing him well, but he has asked, because of what we have done for you and have helped you, would you help us? And look there in verse 10, Nabal answered David's servant, who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There be many servants nowadays that break away every man from his master. And am I going to take my bread and my water and these things that I have killed for my shears and give it to men whom I know not whence they be? And so that report comes back to David. And David's ready to go to war. He's ready to go to battle. This will not stand. Again, I have to wonder if that's not one of those things in David's life. Does he have a right? He certainly had the right to ask. He certainly had a right to have that expectation that we've helped you. Is there anything that you can do to help us? Would you repay us in this way? Certainly we see the foolishness, the ingratitude, the selfishness of Nabal that is going to be condemned. Certainly we know the foolishness of being an ungrateful people. But here's David that is ready almost to react in rage. Mm-hmm. And I'll come back to that in just a moment. He prepares to march on Nabal. I'm going to destroy him. And a report will go out to Abigail. This is Nabal's wife. David is coming ready for war. And she comes out. I love verse 25. Let not my lord regard this man of Belial. I know what a worthless character my husband is right. Basically the report that I get from her. I know that he is a worthless character. Here, I have brought great provisions out for you. I pray you don't do this great thing against Nabal that you will regret. A few things that I do want to point out, and we're quickly running out of time, but verse 30, she points forward and she says, it's going to come to pass that when the Lord does to you according to the good that he's spoken concerning you and appoints you ruler over Egypt, over Israel, this shall be no grief unto you. David, you're going to have so much more if you would but have patience. Don't do this great thing. And even David is going to recognize the wisdom there when she says, God's going to give you so much more. Verse 33, blessed be thy advice and blessed be you that you have kept me this day from coming to shed blood and from avenging mine own self with, or avenging myself with mine own hand. You've shown wisdom. Mm-hmm. And David there, I think, even recognizes, I reacted in haste. Rather than letting the Lord have his vengeance, I wanted to carry it out myself. And you've shown me that wisdom. And sometimes I think we want what we think is ours right now. Sometimes we need that wisdom of Abigail to say, how much more will the Lord bless me with in due time, in his time, in due season, and wait patiently for him, even as is going to be seen in verse 37 through 39, that Nabal, within 10 days, is going to be dead. He's going to get what's coming to him. And his foolishness will catch up with him. And so we see that again in David's life. Not always perfect, not the right reaction. He flew off the handle, I think, is what we're seeing. But we see the wisdom of a woman that would come and calm him, and David would choose those right actions. Maybe a concluding remark there for us, Chip?
No, just reflecting on what I said a moment ago, David's still learning lessons. And here, even at a hand of a wonderful woman named Abigail, who we had married.
All right. Very good, very good. And we are remark that he would take her unto wife. And I'm going to leave that. Chip will open, Lord willing, tomorrow morning, 1 Samuel 26 through 31, looking at the increasing marriages of David, even that falls here at the end of 25, and also looking there at the death of Saul. So I hope that you will be able to be with us. As always, we thank you for joining us here for Mornings for the Master.
Bye.
Been listening to Mornings for the Master on the Gospel Radio Network. Remember to join us each weekday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Central Standard Time, or catch the replay at 9 p.m. Central Time. You can also contact us at mornings@tgrn.org if you have any questions we can help you with, or if you have events you would like to submit to our bulletin board, or just with general feedback about the program or network. We would love to hear from you. As we've had opportunity to spend time with the Master this morning in His Word, let's remember His words in Luke 6:46, when He said, "Why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say?" He goes on to say in verse 47 and 48, "Whosoever cometh to me and heareth my sayings and doeth them, I will show to you whom he is like. He is like a man which built an house and digged deep and laid the foundation on a rock. And when the flood arose, the stream beat vehemently upon that house and could not shake it, for it was founded upon a rock." Let's show the wisdom of that builder and go now to live for the Master.